back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and over there on the other side of the internet is Mr. David Pasquarello. What's up, Dave?
Hey, hello there.
Hello there.
Been a
That's,
while.
What's his name? Marty Allen used to. That was his line. Hello there. Is anybody old enough to remember that guy? So, what's going on?
Not much. Things are fairly quiet. Trying to get back in the groove. We went on vacation. Now it's back to the grindstone of work. You know, for every bit of pleasure you get in life is an equal amount of pain. And that's coming back to
it. It does seem that way, doesn't it? Well, I can say I haven't really been doing any comic buying recently, but I did buy, and I know this is not a... not a true collector's item or something that has true value, but it's kind of cool. On Facebook Marketplace, there's a guy and he was selling what he called production pages for comics. And I got a page from Spider-Man 71. But what they are they're reproductions. So they're essentially high quality copies of the original art that they use for other, you know, for printing and things or whatever. So it's not really the original art. It's just a copy of it. But I got a page for that. And it was in a nice frame with a border and everything for $50. So I thought that was kind of cool. I have that hanging my office now. You know, I've had the desire to have a decent piece of original art. But my standards would be it has to be an artist who I know. And there have to be characters I know depicted on the page. And... really, anything that I want is just priced way out of my price range. It's just, you know, to the point of kind of crazy.
So that's because most of the artists you really know are dead by now.
Yeah, well, that's the case here. You know, this is a John Romita Sr., and it's got a page of Spider-Man fighting Quicksilver. So it fits my criteria, but if it was truly the original page, probably would have cost a couple of $1,000s. So for $50, I have the pretend version of it.
But an original would go up in value. It's an investment.
Well, you know what? It's just going to stay on my wall anyway. So the only one who I'm costing money with this is my heirs. Because I doubt I'd be selling it while I was still alive anyway. So, and you know what would probably happen is I'd have this thing hanging up in the house that was worth thousands of dollars. They wouldn't know it. I'd die, and they'd sell it at a garage sale for $15.
Right, and then you'd see someone else on Antique Roadshow going, look at what I found in this, I bought it for the frame.
Yeah, exactly. So this is a much better situation in the long run. So.
Good. I haven't bought any comic stuff at all. I bought, it came when I got back, my Jay Garrick Superpowers figure.
Oh, that's cool.
So I'm very pleased with that. My Justice Society ranks are filling up rather nicely.
I had Justice Society 6-inch figures. I think actually they may have been 4-inch figures, and I had a row of them. And I don't know what happened to them. Somewhere along the lines when I moved 4 years ago, they got dispersed somehow. They were pretty much Justice Society figures, and then I had the Kingdom Come Superman with them, who looks Golden Age Superman-ish, so I thought that was cool to fit in with them.
Did you have them after that time Scott stayed at your house? Were they still
I think I may have had them when he came over, and they may have been gone when he left.
Yeah. You know, things happen.
Yeah, who knows? There might have been a fire. I don't know. But, I mean, I had you know, the Golden Age Hawkman. I had Dr. Midnight, the Golden Age Flash. I'm trying to remember who else was. There were about 10 of them, but I can't even remember all the ones that I had.
I think those were six. I know, I'm familiar. There was a set. I think they were 6-inch. They were bigger than 4, I think.
I thought they were four, but then again, I don't remember, and they're gone. So.
Well, they're yours, so you would know better than me. I should just shut up.
that's the true beauty of a podcast, when we just shut up. So, yeah, that's it. No other comic collecting news today, but Dave and I each picked a random issue. I've been sitting on Champions number 3 for a while that we were going to do several recording sessions where I had this one ready to go and never actually did it, although I haven't written a synopsis. But anyway, and Dave has a Detective Comics issue, and I think since yours is the older book, yours is 1970, why don't we go with yours first?
Okay. I actually wrote a detailed synopsis. I'm never doing that off the cuff again. That was a debacle last week, and again, well, 2 weeks ago, and I apologize for that again. Okay, my book is Detective Comics number 405. This predates my existence on the planet. Cover date, November 1970. An on sale date of September 29th, 1970. For a whopping 15 cents. And we're going to be covering the main story. There's also a backup story in this issue. It's, I believe it's a Batgirl story, but we're not going to deal with that. And the title of this story is The First of the Assassins, written by Denny O'Neill, penciler Bob Brown, inker Frank Chicoya, and editor Julius Schwartz. Batman arrives on the roof of police headquarters in response to the blazing bat signal. Commissioner Gordon informs him that he has received an urgent request from Interpol regarding the murder of several in Europe that has just taken place recently. 15 of Europe's leading shipping magnates have been recently murdered, and according to their information, the next target is shipping magnate K.C. Agonistes, whose boat is currently in Gotham Harbor. Since he has refused police protection, Gordon is unable to do anything officially and hopes that Batman can act unofficially on his behalf. An hour later, a launch laden with supplies heads toward the yacht. As the man named Jack sets foot upon the deck, an alarm sounds, as Jack is an imposter. Quickly, the imposter is revealed to be Batman. K.C. Agonistes, his fiancée, Bettina Smith, and his employees greet Batman with pleasure, and they welcome him to be part of their journey. K.C. explains that his entire crew all have transistorized signals buried beneath the skin behind their ear, and if the signal is not detected, an alarm sounds. After taking a closer look at other security measures on the ship, Batman starts patrolling the deck at night. Batman notices a disturbance in the water. A sailor dismisses it as it is just a pack of dolphins, but Batman tells him to evacuate the ship. Batman uses a crewman's rifle and tries to stop the incoming danger. The dolphins are packed with explosives, and their impact destroys the ship. Batman reaches the lifeboat, where a sailor, K.C. and Bettina have escaped, but the rest of the crew is dead. They sail to a nearby island, which at first seems deserted. But Batman soon notices that there definitely is someone present. Batman barely saves Bettina from a falling spiked death trap, and then saves K.C. from a thrown silk stiletto. Batman goes inland to search for the killer. He soon realizes that he has been lured away from his companions, and as he rushes back, he is trapped by a snare. As Batman hangs from a tree by a vine snare, a thin, nimble, and Hard Man approaches him. This is Taya, who is not impressed with the great American he has heard of. Taya is off to kill the others, and then will return to finish off Batman. Batman breaks free from the trap and heads back to the camping site. As Taya confronts the armed sailor, the sailor's revolver fails to fire, and Taya quickly knocks him out. Batman arrives just in time to prevent the assassin from killing Casey and Bettina. As they battle, the assassin reveals that he is part of a larger faction known as the League of Assassins, which cannot be bribed or stopped. Taya gets the upper hand in the fight and is ready to eliminate Batman when he suddenly is blinded by flares that Batman had hidden in his cape. Batman defeats the assassin, but he knows that he is just a pawn in a larger scheme. Batman explains he found footprints made by a much larger man than Taya. Further, Taya could not have trained a school of kamikaze dolphins. Somewhere out there is an arch criminal mastermind, the leader of the League of Assassins. The story ends with a text box proclaiming, "They strike, they kill. The League of Assassins, the most awesome foes ever to clash with the Batman. Who are these merciless killers? What is their purpose? And what is the sinister secret of their leader?" Do you know who their leader is, Paul? Have you ever heard of these people?
I wouldn't have known in November of 1970, since he hadn't been introduced yet.
In fact, they're claiming it's the mysterious Dr. Dark with two R's. So I don't know what that's about. But the answers are coming soon in forthcoming issues of Detective Comics.
To a theater near you.
What did you think of this?
From its historical perspective, introducing the League of Assassins and then leaving a little mystery as to who their leader is and introducing him to us later in an iconic book, I think it's very cool with hindsight to read this. I think if I had read it back in 1970 without knowing its significance, I might have thought, oh, yeah, that was an okay read. But I'm much more enthusiastic about it because I know who their leader is and where it's going to go to some extent. Now, who was Ra's al Ghul's thug, the big guy that he had with him?
I don't know. I haven't gotten to that yet.
I forget what his name is, but I assume that's whose footprints that they're seeing at the end of this. I am generally not a huge fan of Bob Brown's art. It's generally what I like to term workmanlike, but I feel like there's a little bit of a Neil Adams influence on the layouts that he had here, and I think it's better than what I'm used to from him. So overall, I really enjoyed this book.
You know, I've never read any of these, and I loaded up my iPad for the trip. I started in December of 69, and Batman and Detective, and I was reading them in order.
Right.
And this is what I got up to. This was my last hurrah. So I haven't actually ever read the reveal of Ra's al Ghul. So
I think that's
this
only
is all new.
I'm pretty sure that's only about 5 or 6 months off.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward.
You'll get to that soon, and that's unless I'm misremembering something, that's Neil Adams art, and that's classic stuff.
And that's the cover where Batman is shirtless or something, or no? Which is the one where it reveals him? I think I've got it here. I just haven't gotten to it yet.
It is an iconic issue, and let me just see. First, I don't want to...
Maybe I don't have it here. You know which one I'm thinking of? I think I'm thinking of that oversized one.
Batman 232. Batman 232.
Do I have that here? I do. Yes, right, with the green misty background.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I'm almost there.
Yeah, the shirtless one I think is down the road. I think that's another storyline. That's actually, hold on, that's showing up here on my Wikipedia. On my,
no, that whole bunch of these Batman giants that are just republications of old stuff.
Right.
And it's very, they're from the 50s mostly, and they're very, very, very text heavy. And they're giant size. So that slowed me up, but I didn't want to skip them.
Okay, the one without the shirt is 244.
Okay. 244. All right. And so I've got about, let's see, how far did I get? I read up to 228. I'm like less than 20 issues to go.
Yeah, this is, as I never read every issue of this. In fact, this was the first time I ever read this particular issue. But the ones I've read in this time frame are all pretty solid. So I think you're going to enjoy doing this run as long as they don't throw in too many 1950s books. I got a kick out of this female companion of the guy that he's defending, the way she was basically fawning over Batman.
Yeah.
I think if it was a more mature book, they'd have some point where she was like trying to go to his cabin at night.
Well, that's where I kind of thought it was going, but I guess you have to factor in the time that this was done. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know what I found very interesting about this time period is it's very, from what I know, kind of like the opposite of Marvel almost, where it's still very like the establishment. There's backup stories that started with Dick Grayson having just gone off to college, and it's like Robin's adventures in college. Mm-hmm. And it's like pushing the theme of course you can trust people over 30. You know, you got to watch out for these radicals on the campus.
Well, I we've said many times that Marvel moved from the Silver Age to the Bronze Age several years before DC did. In fact, DC started the Silver Age with introducing the Flash, you know, the new Flash, the new Green Lantern, all of that. But I think, you know, even the early 1960s Marvel issues, which were, you know, somewhat less sophisticated, still took things to another level from what DC was doing. Because I think they gave the heroes everyday problems. Whereas the DC heroes, most of them were still millionaires. They had no financial issues to think about. And, you know, there wasn't, you know, a lot of deep storytelling. Then, you know, eventually, you know, DC kind of lagged behind. And then when it came to going from the Silver Age to the Bronze Age, DC seemed to be like a bunch of fits and starts where, you know, they'd have a little bit more of a sophisticated run in Batman, you know, with Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams, or a little bit more of a sophisticated run in Green Lantern and Green Arrow. But then they'd still be doing, you know, the Superman, you know, on the cover where he's eating every hamburger on Earth and not sharing them, you know, so.
Or the phone booth bursting because he's gotten fat.
Yeah, things like that. You know, they definitely, you know, we're trying to appeal to a younger audience for a longer period of time than Marvel was. You know, Marvel was trying to get an older audience in there. And then, you know, eventually the 70s were kind of, the Marvel moved into the Bronze Age in the 70s. DC was kind of in flux through most of the 70s and really fully entered the more sophisticated era in the 80s. So, you know, it's all just a style of reading and style of writing that you got to kind of be used to. This is fine, though. This is a good story as far as I'm concerned.
Fun and a great story.
Yeah, and I, like I said, I feel like the artwork is a step up from what I'm used to from Bob Brown. Do we know who the inker was on this?
I had it listed as
Frank Giacoya. Yeah. I don't know who to give. Well, certainly the layouts are Brown, and they are all pretty solid. He didn't go with just your standard point of view on every shot. He changed it up. He has some storytelling here. It moves along pretty quickly, but there's a lot going on. Even the fight at the end with Batman and the assassin, you know, it seems like it's pretty well choreographed. It's all pretty cool. I really enjoyed this.
There's still, at this point, Gotham is not what it becomes. Do you know what I mean? Gotham is still portrayed in these books as like, oh, it's a fine city. You know, it's not overrun with crime. And, you know, the police are honest and hardworking. And, you know, Batman's clearly an agent of the police still here.
Yeah, no, there's definitely that element going on in here. But, you know, on the other hand, I could accept that.
No, I'm not complaining about it. I kind of like it, to be honest with you.
You know, when you get into the real Silver Age-y or Golden Age-y DC books, I usually feel like I could read a couple of them and then I have to go to something different. Because I get tired of, I don't want to use pejorative terms, but, you know, feeling like it's dumbed down. I can accept them from the point of view that they're trying to present them in smaller doses when they're like that, when they're aimed towards younger kids, basically.
Well, that's why I skipped to the 70s, because I needed a break from the 40s.
Yeah, but this stuff, you know, basically the stuff that Denny O'Neil did with Neil Adams for the most part, or, you know, and I know that that's coming up very soon in Batman here. You know, it had a better presentation level and a greater sophistication than the other stuff that was coming out. And I can read this stuff in big bunches. I don't feel the need to, you know, I read three of these. I have to read something else to cleanse my palate. You know, that's not the case. Right. That's not the case with these. But then, you know, you move on and we're not going to do the second story. But the second story with Batgirl, even though it's Gil Kane art, which I love, still doesn't feels more Silver Age-y.
Yeah, well, yeah. Well, and then there's a backup story to that. You get three stories in this book for 15 cents. And the third one is, I believe it's a reprint.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
That's just like
a, you know, random horror story.
With a detective and his head stuck in with a bomb on his head.
It's only six pages long, too. But at a nickel a story, it's, you know, you're getting your money's worth here.
Yeah. This was a hell of a lot of fun.
I also really like the Neil Adams cover. The only thing is it's misrepresenting a little bit, because you have Batman in the tree, you know, with the assassins coming towards him. And there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 assassins coming at him. Meanwhile, he only deals with one assassin in this book.
You know what I really love about this cover? The way the moonlight illuminates the edges and the way it shines onto just his chest, it looks like the bat signal in the sky.
And it's also, you know, it makes sense because the branch of the tree is providing the shade.
It's just a beautiful cover right there, even though it's not quite what's in the book.
Well, sometimes with these issues, you get the Neil Adams cover and you think, oh, that's beautiful. I need that book. And then you open it up and it's got, you know, some, you know, mediocre art inside of it. And you're like, oh, God, why did I let myself get fooled by this cover? This isn't the case with this one. This one's got a good story. And again, like I said, you know, I'm not a huge Bob Brown fan, but this artwork is solid.
Do you know who the shipping magnate in my head that I keep thinking of?
Aristotle Onassis,
right?
Because it's the only shipping magnate of that era that I know. So I was able to figure that one out.
I kept thinking if she had black hair instead of blonde hair, it would have been perfect. Should we do the rating?
Sure.
I'm not going to bury the lead. I love the cover. I gave it an A minus, with the only minus part because of the it's not quite what's in the book. But that's just a minor complaint. The story I gave a solid A minus as well. And the art, I love the interior art. I think it's fantastic. I gave it a straight up A for an overall grade of an A minus on this book.
All right. Well, I'm going to say an A plus on the cover because I think it's really good. And even though it's misleading, I'm fine with it. The interior art, I'm going to put it at a B plus, not quite an A minus, but really close to it. And the story, I'm going to say an A. I thought the story was really good. So overall, I'll give the book an A.
Nice.
So from there, we go to The Champions, number 3. I assume you have no familiarity with this series.
I do not.
And I'm going to read a bit from Marvel Wikipedia about
Champions. Did you read the first two with this?
I read them years ago, and then I reread them when I had read this.
Okay.
But according to a letters page of Champions number 6, writer Tony Isabella developed the concept of a new team of superheroes and originally wanted the roster to consist of former X-Men, the Angel and Iceman, and the newly created Black Goliath. Black Goliath became unavailable when the character debuted in his own title, forcing Isabella to rethink the concept. Editor Len Wein insisted on at least 5 members, and Isabella added 3 established heroes: Russian spy Black Widow, the Greek god Hercules, and the supernatural Avenger Ghost Rider. Captain Marvel, Power Man, and the Son of Satan were all considered for the final place on the roster before selecting Ghost Rider. Writer and publisher David Anthony Kraft is credited with naming the team, with the title originally intended to be published in the giant size format, such as Giant Size Champions. Production difficulties, which caused a 3-month delay between the first and second issues, prevented this. I'm going to just leave it at that. That's the first paragraph. It goes on a little bit, but that gives you a little bit of a background. Now, basically, the first two issues have these heroes all kind of meeting, you know, based on coincidences at UCLA when they're attacked by the Greek villainous gods, Pluto and Ares and... trying to remember, I think it's Apolta. But anyway, and they have Zeus, like, bamboozled into thinking that he has to, like, force an arranged marriage on Hercules and Venus for, you know, to keep peace. Anyway, I was not going to... The Wikipedia or the Marvel Wiki synopsis kind of sucks. And I was just going to do one off the cuff, but there is one on MarvelHeroesLibrary.com. So I'm going to read that one. But first, mm-hmm. I'll tell you our creative team here is... why is this cut off on me? There we go. It's writers Jenny Blake Isabella, credited under a different name, Bill Mantlo. Penciled by George Tuska, who is not one of my favorites. Inked by Vince Coletta, not one of my favorites. Colored by George Roussos, lettered by Gaspar Saladino and Karen Mantlo, and edited by Marv Wolfman. The cover date is February of 1976, and it was released on November 25th of 1975. Now, the Marvel Heroes synopsis, written by Peter Silvestro, thank you, Peter Silvestro, says, in the wake of their defeat by the Huntsman in the last issue, Black Widow, Angel, and Iceman have taken refuge at a beachfront cabin. Bobby is really broken up about it, brooding over his failures with the X-Men, as well as the recent adventure. Johnny Blaze rides up with good news. He knows how to get to Olympus. The others scoff, but Johnny points out that the ice mountain Iceman made to block a portal is still there, and the portal to Olympus beneath. Meanwhile, in Olympus, Zeus is angry over being tricked by Pluto into marrying his son, Hercules, to Hippolyta. Dionysus tries and fails to comfort him. Nearby, Pluto takes delight in his scheme to invade Olympus. Ares and Hippolyta laugh along. Hercules goes to confront his father, but the mutates mock Herc, reminding him that the wedding is his father's decree. Herc curses his dad for a coward and leaves. Elsewhere, the Huntsman, bored with wedding talk, discovers the Ice Mountain just as the heroes break through, the ice weakened by Ghost Rider's Hellfire. The heroes beat up the mutates. As the principals gather in the throne room and Hercules and Venus await their fates, Huntsman enters with the news of the arrival of the champions. Angel follows, seizes hold of one end of Huntsman's staff, and flips him into a wall, knocking him cold. Pluto demands the interlopers be tossed out. Hercules punches Ares' lights out. Venus uses her love powers to turn Hippolyta's sword into a plowshare. And I would just throw a comment there that that's a reference to the Bible right there. And then bops her over the head with it, which is basically not what it was meant to do in the Bible. Pluto stops the champions in their tracks, being much more powerful than any of them. But Ghost Rider knows someone more powerful. He tells Zeus that Pluto has been lying to him, intending to destroy Olympus with his new dead gods association. Zeus banishes Pluto from Olympus. Zeus asks Herc and Venus what punishment should be bestowed on the bad guys, and Venus asks forgiveness, arguing their own evil is punishment enough. Herc and his dad make up, and dad lets him join his friends as they return to Earth. So that's what happens when I read a synopsis by someone else. Good times.
It sounded like a fantastic job.
I think it was. Thank you again, Peter Silvestri. This is one of my one of the things I really enjoy is some of these short run series. Now, this series I actually enjoyed when it was coming out. I was purchasing it at the time, and I would have liked for this to have been a long run series. But I do have a soft spot for, you know, series that ran, you know, 10, 15 issues and then were canceled, and I like to kind of get all of them and then have that complete series. So I have that on this, and I loved the concept of this is a group of heroes that nobody in their right mind would say belong together. You know, it's just such a disparate group that I got a big kick out of them from the start. They didn't know what to do with this series. They had a bunch of different artists and writers over the course of the 17 issues that it ran, but some of them stood out. John Byrne in particular, in his very early Marvel days, did a few issues, and they were really cool. So I have a soft spot for this series in general. I could do without Angel wearing a banana hammock in the beginning of it.
I was going to say something about
But thankfully, that. They only show that in one panel. And I mentioned that George Tuska and Vince Coletta are not two of my favorite artists. George Tuska because I'm just not a fan of his style. And Vince Coletta because if you've ever heard any of our tales of Vince Coletta, you know, he was renowned for being incredibly quick. And sometimes that would be a sacrifice of quality in order to get that speed. And that was always kind of a letdown when he would do that, especially with Kirby. You know, there were tales, and they are warranted because I've seen evidence of it, of him erasing backgrounds that Kirby drew just to speed along the inking process and you know, diminishing the artwork that we were getting. So they're not two of my favorites. But all of that said, I think the artwork is pretty decent in this one. It's not great, but it's very easy to follow the story. There's no particular shots that really bother me. So this is superior George Tuska, I will say. And I got a kick out of the story. It was a little simplistic with the, oh, he fooled you. Now we know the truth. We're going to just let it go. But it was still cool. I think, you know, we created a team dynamic here where they're not all close friends, but, you know, they're kind of joining up. And, you know, it made me want to read more, and I did. I enjoyed this series. I enjoyed this issue. Now, you, as a newcomer who knows nothing about this series and probably doesn't even know all the characters, what did you think?
Oh, it was entertaining. I'll give it that. You know, I thought the art was very detailed, considering. You know what I'm saying? I had one question, though, as far as the Huntsman.
Yes.
I'm not quite familiar with the character. Is there a point where Batman shows up and punches him in the face?
There should be. And then we could have...
I mean, does the Rock and the Guy Gardner bowl cut?
He was kind of a mort in this issue because he was beaten so easily. But in the previous issue, he proved to be kind of tough.
It certainly had a lot of action. I'm not a big fan of the whole gods thing. You know, Hercules and Pluto and Zeus. I keep thinking of Samuel L. Jackson going, it's, hey, Zeus, you know, like lightning bolt.
Yeah.
Hey, Zeus. The Black Widow looked pretty good on page one.
Yes, you know, I mean, I guess it's not really fair that I'm going to criticize the Angel for wearing a small swimsuit, but enjoy seeing the Black Widow in her small swimsuit. So I admit that isn't the most fair thing to any female readers of this book. But
I'm pretty happy the banana hammock is no longer in style. At least I don't think so. No, but the action scenes are fantastic. There's a lot of battles in there. The Ghost Rider looks very cool on the motorcycle. So now this is Hippolyta, as in Wonder Woman's mother, right?
Yeah, and here I guess she's not quite as nice of a person as she is in Wonder Woman.
I guess you could say the same thing in reverse about Hercules, too, huh?
Yeah, didn't they have Hercules? Well, certainly...
Hercules is a bad guy, basically, in DC, I think.
I always got a kick out of Hercules in Marvel Comics, and I, you know, it comes from, or it started, back when they had the old Marvel superheroes cartoons with the, basically the still pictures that they tried to make look like they were moving.
Right.
And they had done the storyline that was in Thor 125, 126, around there, with Thor fighting against Hercules, and then Hercules being fooled into basically selling his soul and having to get it back. A lot of trickster stuff going on with these gods. But that was one, you know, I remembered it from way back when, and I have those issues now, and I always got a kick out of them. And Hercules, I always said, back when they did Batman the Brave and the Bold, when they would do Aquaman on there, that's Marvel's Hercules.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
He was always looking to throw down and fight with somebody, you know?
It was an exciting battle. Nobody yelled out, dial IXII, though.
So overall, like I said, I kind of love this series. 17 issues, and then they had to wrap it up in Spectacular Spider-Man. They had a two-issue story where they finished out what went on here. But I would have liked to have seen this particular series run on for a longer time. I always got a kick out of the team of heroes that don't seem to belong together.
Right.
And that's definitely what we have here, except for Angel and Iceman, who were, you know, teammates with the X-Men before they were here. Nobody really seems to fit. So,
what was the deal? What brought these particular characters together to form the team?
Well, they all happen to be, like, by the UCLA campus for some reason. I know Venus, who doesn't return with them here, was actually in a human guise where she was going to be a teacher at the school, and I think there was some sort of presentation going on about Hercules, so he was actually accompanying her, and I think maybe Iceman was enrolling in some classes there at that time, and I don't really have any memory as to why Black Widow or Ghost Rider would have been there. I would have to go back and look over that issue again, but they all just happened to coincidentally be in the same area when Pluto and Ares and Hippolyta attacked.
Cool. It would have been nice if someone said to Pluto, "Oh, you named after the dog."
They went on later with Ares, where he was, you know, in much, much later, you know, somewhere in the 2000s, where he had his own series, you know, mini series, and he was presented as a, you know, much more compelling character.
Well, they certainly mined a lot of mythology for this.
Yeah, well, that, you know, Marvel was big on that. You know, that why waste it? It's there and it's
Right.
in the public domain. So you know, the, between the Thor stuff with all the Norse legends and the Greek stuff, and you know, they've hit on Roman stuff as well. So there's a lot of the gods. So
yeah, it was a fun romp.
Yeah, I thought so. So I guess I'll rate this. Cover is extremely busy, but it's dynamic. It's got Hercules front and center, which was really, you know, one of the things that they did pretty much all the time. But everybody's got their own moment on there. Everybody's doing something. One of the things I like is everybody's motions or shots are actually, they actually make sense. They're hitting somebody. Okay. They're making contact. It's not just, you know, random things being thrown around. And then we have, you know, Pluto and Zeus looking on and watching the battle. I'm going to say a B+. It's probably a little too busy, but otherwise it's really good. And the cover, by the way, is by Rich Buckler. The interior art, again, not my favorite combination, but pretty solid. I'm going to say a B+ on the interior art as well. And the story, to me, the story was just fun. I'm gonna go B+ all around and give it on the story as well.
I like the cover just a little bit more than you. I like the feel that it reminds me of, like, it's on the floor of the Colosseum with the emperors looking down, watching the show. And I picked up, as you did, every action has a reaction. Where you specifically see, you know, Iceman firing his ice beams off and it hitting specific characters, the impact of Hercules' fist, the result of Johnny Blaze's fire. So I gave it an A-. I like the cover a lot. I can't help but think of Zeus and Pluto sitting in the luxury boxes. I like the interior art as well. I'm going to be with you. I'm not going to beat a dead horse. I gave it a B+. And the story, too, was a B+ for me. For an overall grade, I'm a solid B+ on this one.
Yeah, it's. I would, you know, if you like this, I would recommend the rest of the series. Even though it's got different writers, its focus is a little off. It's just a fun series. So
take now, that for what it's worth. When they end the series, does the last book say, read Spider-Man, whatever, for the wrap-up, or it's just you had to stumble across it?
You had to stumble across it. I don't remember specifically, but I think there may have been a gap in time between the end of the series and when they got around to wrapping it up in Spider-Man.
At least you got a wrap-up.
Yeah, and that's the bottom line to me. So, all right, well, two fun books, and thanks for joining me to do these, Dave.
It was a blast, my friend, as usual.
Thank you, everybody, for listening, and we'll be back next week with something else. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.